It is Saturday, May 31st, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news and a discussion of software development with David I from CodeGear.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Miles Elam, student, programmer, and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning, Lyle.
And our special guest, David I, vice president, development relations, and chief engineer at CodeGear. Hi.
Chief evangelist. Good morning.
Oh, really?
Chief cheerleader.
Cheerleader. Okay. We'll go with that. And we're going to go ahead and do geek news before we start talking about CodeGear and software development. And thank you, David, for being here. And please chime in if you can help enlighten us or confuse us. Miles, we'll start with you for news.
Google is looking to host open source libraries for faster access. One of their initiatives, the Google Ajax search API, as it were.
So we're talking about JavaScript. Libraries.
JavaScript libraries such as Scriptaculous, Prototype, Dojo, jQuery, and MooTools.
And these are basically scripts that you can use to make JavaScript a lot easier to develop per system. So, for example, I don't know if I've got anything
right. They're browser
running.
Enhancements to make dynamic web pages easier.
Right.
To do a lot of the heavy lifting so that all you have to worry about is the aspects of your program. All of these are competing.
To some degree,
competing
yeah.
libraries to a large extent. But what happens is every developer who wants to use these libraries has to put them onto their web page and host those files on their own site, which means that if you go to 20 sites that are using Prototype, you have to download the same version and the same code 20 different times.
Right.
So what Google is doing is offering a chance for anyone to just point to their servers, and instead of and taking advantage of browser caching so that whenever you go to download a script, if you download it, then the next time a site needs to use that same version, it goes to the Google site. The Google site says, oh, no, you already have it, and you're able to load that page faster.
Which would make JavaScript libraries faster for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only concern would be is that Google, again, is being this central repository of content, and therefore they'd be able to track who's coming to what sites and such, assuming that the browser hadn't cached it. So let's say geekspeak.org points a jQuery script to Google. Anybody that goes the first time to geekspeak.org, Google's going to get a hit that says, hey, somebody came. And if they then also go and search on Google's site with cookies as a tracking mechanism, there's a way to kind of negotiate where your audience is coming from.
Assuming they put cookies onto the Prototype libraries,
right.
That would be true. I don't know if that's the case.
No, but they can still read the cookies from the Prototype, because when the browser asks, it will
On the contrary, you can only read cookies from the domain that it came from.
No, what I'm
so
saying is
Google could set a cookie that they themselves could read.
Right.
But they can't read
what I'm describing, Miles, is okay. You go to Google and you do a search for baskets, and so you get a whole bunch of basket pages back. Google has thrown a cookie back to your browser that says, hey, this is some person who happened to be searching for baskets on this day. Then 3 days later, they go to geekspeak.org and they learn all about this wonderful basket weaving show that we did. And happens to be the same person, whatever. They come to the show, they come to our site and ask Google for their JavaScript library. Well, then Google knows that a person that goes to Geekspeak also 3 days ago searched for baskets on their site because it's the same browser. And it's the same domain.
If they were tracking down to that level, which they could.
Yeah.
I don't know if they do on that level. I think they do it more.
Maybe it doesn't matter that much because of the increase. So I guess the question is the URL going to be a Google.com URL? And I'm assuming it would be.
Yes, it will be. Yeah. It's a Google APIs.com
in any case,
URL.
I'm probably just adding more.
There are actually two different things here. There's one which is the public URL of ajax.googleapis.com. You go through and say, for example, Ajax libs prototype 1602. prototype.js. So it's not just the library, but the particular
version
number. They also offer a Ajax library API. And that's one where
they
you load. Right. You load up just a Google one and then say which library you want. And it loads in that library on the fly in the background.
Right. Right. Using HTML request object. The XML request objects, if you will.
But it's doing JSON.
It's doing JSON here. But still using that object. That's interesting. I mean, I wonder if the browser would still cache that because it's the same domain. So it could be an increase to the label Ajax web development.
Right. By all means, Google is gathering information from this. Yeah. I mean, that's their rationale for doing it. Sure. But I also tend to think of it as, wow, this is going to make things more efficient. The amount of time that we're downloading this library, it will make some change. I don't know if it will offset all of the traffic you would get from, say, YouTube.
Right.
But, you know, any little bit perhaps, and it will help people who are on slower internet connections.
Right. And it's kind of a versioning, it solves versioning problems for developers, too, in some sense, because you don't have to worry about the library having a copy of the version. You just point to the right URL for that version, and Google takes care of it. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Elam, for that. Ryder, next news story.
Also in Google News, we have Android has been demonstrated by Google. They have a nice bunch of video clips illustrating what Google can do, and it's really shaping up.
Android is Google's phone software.
Yep, their open platform development, which is shaping up quite nicely from what I've seen. It's it's definitely going to be some competition going forward against the iPhone. Basically, the Android is a similar touchscreen phone-based interface that they'll have.
And Google specifically has specified the interface and is writing the software, but they're not doing the hardware development, right? They're having other people anybody can build hardware.
Right.
Have you played with one?
No, I have not.
Okay.
I haven't seen it firsthand.
But I believe Google has an IDE that actually emulates the phone, so if you're developing with their package, you can kind of pretend that it exists.
But some interesting cool features that it has is pretty much customizable status bar. It has slidable desktop, so you can, rather than having to deal with a scroll bar interface and scrolling down, you just actually can slide the whole desktop and get a whole new
like
desktop
the iPhone,
so you can
sure.
have actual... I think it's a little different than the iPhone, but aren't you kind of limited with one screen on the iPhone?
No.
No?
But it
gives you the buttons, right?
So I'm doing a demo of the iPhone. So here's the iPhone with the home screen, and there's another one and another one.
Right, but so instead of little icons, you can have an entire application.
Multiple applications running. Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so it's like virtual.
Yeah, and
desktops.
Another really cool thing that they have for their unlock screen, rather than Apple's little slide to unlock, they've actually got a multi-point buttons or little dots on there, and you can create your own pattern as an unlock sequence.
So it's a password protection, too.
Exactly. And you can make it as simple or as complicated as you want.
So you pick your favorite.
I think it has like nine dots that you can do a connect the dot kind of sequence.
So you pick your favorite astrological sign and you use that as your pattern. Okay, that's cool.
So,
all right, so that's Android coming out. When is someone going to start selling this?
I have no idea.
Do you own an iPhone yet, Ryder?
I don't, but I'm probably going to get the next one.
You're not going to wait for Android?
No, I think I'll go for an iPhone.
All right.
I just want a 3G iPhone.
You just want
a 3G? Yeah, me too.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah.
If it has GPS, that'd be great.
You know, the rumors around the iPhone from Apple and stuff is totally, our shipment came into harbor. We think it's going to be there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, AT&T saying, we're enhancing our network. And, really, are you?
And the number of photos that are floating around about the 3G iPhone are just ridiculous at this point.
Photoshop.
Amazing what Photoshop can do, All right, Miles, next news story, sir.
Microsoft is urging Windows users to stop using Safari, the web browser, on Windows. At first glance, that would seem like Microsoft simply trying to get rid of some competition, but...
I read the headline and dismissed it, going, of course Microsoft's trying to do that.
What's going on is Apple Safari on Windows has a security flaw that people are referring to as a carpet bombing. It allows a website to be able to automatically download a file onto the user's hard drive.
Anywhere?
Just to specific areas, from what I understand. You can't overwrite existing system files, for example.
Okay.
But what it does allow you, it does not allow you to double click on an executable, for example, that's been automatically downloaded.
But it lets you put an executable with a special icon anywhere you want, kind of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it could, drop a file on there that says, naked Anna Kournikova pictures or in reference to the Anna Kournikova virus from years back that
Where can it put these files? Is it really that important?
Well, they can put it on the desktop.
Okay.
So
that
would be
a big thing.
Yeah.
Well, who is going to click on something that's on their desktop that they didn't put there?
Anyone who's interested in women, if they saw Anna Kournikova new, they go like, "What is this?" And you double click. Or you might have, "Hey, look, bunnies." And you click. And
so basically someone could put an icon and an executable, which is actually some kind of virus or application that could
or they
your
could
machine.
Make it say and yeah something a something more personal like my notes
right
that people or usually resume. Write all the time yeah, yeah. people mm-hmm. write all the time but you don't even think about yeah. go, what was
you,
this
I you normally this think is. That you're if you're being careful as a web user you're pretty feel pretty safe about opening things on your desktop. So the ability to write bad things on your desktop is a security hole. So is Apple saying, yeah, we're going to fix that?
No, Apple is saying it's not a priority for them.
Interesting.
They've been informed of it, but they haven't really jumped on it to fix it. They haven't seen it as being as big a issue as many other people are. So
can the Apple Safari do that?
Not to my knowledge.
Interesting. All right. Well,
this is just Safari on Windows.
What are we still recommending as a browser of choice for Windows users? Firefox?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was wondering kind of when I saw this headline, I was kind of thinking we might go, yeah, what actually Safari's better than Firefox on a Windows machine. But if the security hole exists, it's not.
Right. I don't know if it's better than Firefox. I was thinking of them as on par, but I would tend to agree with Microsoft that it's not a good idea. Safari at this point is basically just a good development tool.
Yeah.
So you know that your website will work in all browsers.
And even future browsers to some degree, in that Safari's matching CSS3 standards.
And it really is a shame. I'd like to see this bug fixed because Safari has a lot of good things to offer.
Right. But Apple doesn't really care about software running on... I mean, why would they care about Safari running on everybody's Windows machine? It's not like iTunes where they're making money hand over fist by people running it on the Windows machine.
Except that they pushed Safari down a lot of users' throats by bundling it with the last version of iTunes.
Interesting.
And that got raised a few hackles there.
Forced and bundled a security breach browser.
Well, you can choose not to install it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
They pushed it through their software update program, and it was defaulted to be on. And they've since turned it off. And it's
right.
Not
Which and but, you're right. Yeah. You can say, "Oh, I don't want this," sure. But the typical user sees next, finish.
Yes. I agree.
Well, it's like those toolbars. You know, you want Google, Ask, or whatever. I turn all those off too.
Yeah. I recently downloaded and installed something that I wanted to run, and it included the Yahoo toolbar, and I forgot to click it off.
But if you look at your average Joe user, their desktop is littered with everything, and their toolbars are packed with stuff.
Yahoo toolbar and the Google toolbar.
I mean, if you've got Macs and PCs and you're using Safari on the Mac and you want the same experience, you don't want to learn a browser.
Yeah, that's a good use.
And a quick clarification, it is to the default save location. So by default, when you install, it's saving to the desktop. So it's only saving to the desktop.
It saves to the default install. Okay, I get that.
This does affect Windows. It goes to the downloads directory.
You mean Macintosh?
Macintosh, yeah.
Yeah, but in Macintosh environment, when you do download something and you then double-click it, the operating system
there's no
keeps track.
Bit.
It keeps track and says, what are you doing? Right, it gives you a prompt and says, you sure you want to run this application?
Well, run Windows Vista, you got all this access control.
That's
it'll
right.
pop up. You've seen the ads. It'll pop up and ask you,
every
you
single
really
time.
Want to do this? Yeah. So.
People are using Vista?
Wow. I'm using
soon
Vista.
Soon you won't have a choice, I guess, after June.
You know, I'm using Vista 64 as my primary at home, and it's a great operating system. I got 4 gigs of RAM in it, which is really exciting to be able to use. And I've been pretty happy with it.
So when you got Sean for a friend, that's yeah. how it
works out.
Yeah.
Right,
when you got somebody that can have a lip-along, you know, half a gig RAM laptop,
you
it's not really a good selection.
No. But, you know, Sean and I were chatting last night about this, that if you're going to run, the reason to run Vista is to go to 64-bit. Like, that's the reason why you want to go to Vista. In fact, we're not even running Vista 32-bit. Just not. So why switch over? And, of course, yes, David, you're right. They're going to make us eventually. XP won't be supported anymore. We've got to go to Vista, but...
You go find used versions of XP. So
there you go. Yeah, I mean, I've got a box in my garage, which
or you
I don't
buy a
use
Mac.
Anymore.
Or you buy a Mac.
Or
you get the original version of Vista. It's called Tiger.
Do you want to write a little story about the Microsoft developers talking about Vista Tiger?
You can always wonder when Windows apps you want. So keep it on a Mac.
No, we'll save it some other time, though.
All right, let's go on with our subject. Miles and Ryder, thank you for the news. We're going to keep on talking with David Ives. David Inter-Simone. From CodeGear. You are vice president of lots of things, including evangelism, and you've been at Borland for like 23 years. Everybody knows you in the industry as the IDE and software development, kind of pushing from the developer side for corporations to kind of take on the needs of developers. So first off, as a software developer, thank you very much for your career. What's going on with CodeGear being sold by Borland off to somewhere else for $23 million? How's that whole thing going?
So 2 years ago, Borland announced, 2 years ago in February 2006, Borland announced that it was going to look to allow us to go and be a separate company, that Borland had gone on to focus on enterprise lifecycle solutions. And that first round didn't work out, so we became a division of Borland, and we've been running our own business completely for the last 2 years. Our own sales, R&D, support, marketing, everything.
A complete separate unit. Back up for just a second. Borland's focus now, because Borland originally was a software development company. I mean,
sure, Borland had three categories of products. It had personal utilities like Sidekick, SuperKey, Turbo Lightning. It had application products like Quattro, Paradox, Reflex, Sprint, Paradox for Windows, and so on. And when we acquired Ashton Tate, DBase, and a bunch of other things. And we always had developer tools from the days of Turbo Pascal 1 in November 83.
Can we switch your mic so it goes to the side so your air flows on it? Ryder, would you help him out there? Yep, perfect. Okay, go on.
Okay, they're taking care of me here. So originally, Borland had three categories of products. And then over time, we spent all of our time and focused the company on developer tools and developer solutions. And in that, then, over time, we expanded the reach to include things like requirements management and design with UML modeling and testing and deployment and runtimes.
Code Gear is still doing that?
So Code Gear focused entirely on developer tools. So our products for Java, it's called JBuilder, our Windows products, Delphi, C++ Builder. We have a PHP product called Delphi for PHP for visually designing and building PHP server applications. And Third Rail, which is a Ruby and Ruby on Rails development environment.
Mm-hmm. So Borland, basically, its core at this point is for corporate, repairing corporate infrastructure, software tools for that kind of thing.
Portfolio management, requirements management, change management, quality management.
All about software packages to design large corporations.
That's correct.
That's kind of what it is. So CodeGear's been running separately, and there's been some play for a while. CodeGear's kind of looked like a package that Borland could sell, and that's kind of what's been going on, and there's been rumors about it for a while, and it's finally happening.
And that was the goal. And so 2 weeks ago, during Java 1, there was an announcement that an investment firm, Thomas Cressy and Bravo, was going to purchase CodeGear from Borland for $23 million and $7 million of accounts receivable for about $30, $31 million.
And what else do they own, that investment group?
They own many different companies in the medical business. They own software companies. One of the companies they own is called Embarcadero Technologies. They took Embarcadero private last year. And so as part of the announcement of the acquisition from Borland, it was announced that we were going to become part of Embarcadero Technologies. So we'll be CodeGear, and they'll have a database gear division, which their products are for database architects, database developers, and database managers.
Which is very tied into software development. I mean, you really, when you're doing software development, you've got database gurus and you've got software development gurus, and they're talking a lot because that's what they
– probably 80% of the real applications that are out there in the world talk to a database in some fashion. So having the ability to design, develop, manage, and optimize database operations, database application development, and we're on the coding side.
So let's try to simplify what software development really is. Like, what's an IDE?
So IDE stands for Integrated Development Environment. It's a set of tooling to not only let you navigate around source code in your projects, but also edit source code, compile it, debug it, deploy it to wherever it needs to go. Visual design environments for dragging and dropping component-based development to build user interfaces, to connect to databases, and so on.
It's relatively kind of hard to explain in some ways what software development really is, writing programs. But if we can kind of metaphorically move it over, if let's say Miles is a writer and I'm a software developer, I'm using an IDE where Miles is using Microsoft Word. So those are the kind of similar ideas, that it's the environment that you're in that you're doing your work. It just happens to be that the work you're a software development person doing with an IDE is that they're creating new software. So it's kind of feels circular in some ways. So, like your group writes software that allows other people to write software.
So we build the tools that allow developers to build the applications that people use.
This feels like a late night hanging around a fire pit going, dude, this is so weird. But
it's a dark art.
This is correct, yeah. So
we also have developers who use our tools to build tools for developers. So then it really gets involved.
For years, I'm a web developer, and for years I kind of poo-poo the idea of Dreamweaver, these WYSIWYG editors that allow you to edit HTML, because I kind of feel like if you're going to be a web developer, you need to have your HTML skills really strong, and you need to be coding directly as source code, if you will. And so the IDE environment, if you will, for web development, the HTML, is normally a thing called a WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. Dreamweaver is the perfect example of that. And as a software development, I feel like that's like dirty space. And so are there people that go, I don't want an IDE, I just want text files?
So there are all kinds of developers in the world. Some people just use a text editor and then use command line tools to create their applications. Some people like extra capabilities inside an integrated environment. They want to be able to, I'll throw out terms, if you're a programmer out there, refactor your code. Mm-hmm. You can do that by doing global search and replace in a simple editor and dragging and dropping text around or cutting and pasting it in that fashion. Some people want it all inside of an integrated development environment, so they stay inside one focus area, one cockpit, and they can do all the things they want. And it's really up to developers. We provide our products to be used in all those different ways. So mm-hmm. some people use just the command line tools that come with ours, and they use some other parts of the product.
One thing I've found for years in software development when you're doing source code, it is really nice to have a environment which is color coding your code so that you kind of know where functions start and where things keep track of your white space so that your code looks clean and readable, and also has hints. I found it's kind of useful when you can't remember exactly the name of a function, you start typing and it kind of concludes it for you and even fills in the variables that function would take as spaces. And I'm using an application called TextMate.
You use TextMate, sure. Yeah. Programmer's editor that has a lot of extra things stuck
in. It's not an IDE, but though it kind of, as it people start growing it, it's kind of turning a new IDE, which is a little different.
Sure, on the Unix side and other places, people use Emacs as well, which is another popular programmable text editor for programmers.
Yeah, I just kind of want to shiver when people say Emacs, but yes.
No, it's good.
Absolutely. okay, so let's get into the IDE packet. Well, we got to take a break in just a second. What I want to get into is what an IDE can actually do for you, and also how you think about software development in ways that allow you to make tools that work for software developers. Do you have to really conceptualize what people need? So we'll get into that in just a second. We're talking with David I from CodeGear. You're listening to GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. My name is Lyle Troxell. We're taking calls now on GeekSpeak with questions and comments about technology. You're welcome to ask us anything you'd like about software development. David's an expert in Pascal. He knows Java and probably a multitude of other languages and knows a lot about software development concepts. And if you're interested in any of those things, please call us with questions and comments. We are taking any questions today, of course. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. You're welcome to send us email if you're a little shy or just want to have a longer dialogue. With the way we're kind of doing the texting at this point is through our web forum. So just go to geekspeak.org and click on forums. Stay tuned with KUSP right after GeekSpeak. We're doing the auction. That's right. It's the 32nd annual KUSP radio auction, and it's just a half an hour from now. So if you've got your auction book, grab it, get a cup of coffee, and it's going to be just a half an hour to do that. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks, and we are talking with David Eyes. How do you do it?
Singular.
Okay, David I. It's actually David Intersimone, but everyone goes into her, wouldn't it? So it's David I, and everyone knows who that is in the software development world. All right, let's get to the question. Well, GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers for appointments and more information, 423-2447. You're welcome to call and ask us anything you'd like today, though we are focused on software development. The phone numbers, again, are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. So I kind of prompted you with some questions prior to going to that little break. What did I ask you?
You were asking about IDE. What kind of things do IDEs provide and what people need to think about in the world of software development?
Yeah. Go for it.
Well, again, in the beginning of time in development, you brought up an editor of some kind and you just typed in lines of code. Or if you go way back, you punched cards or punched paper tape and you sent it off to a computer. You got the results back or you got errors back. In an integrated environment, we can control the whole process of software development. We can guide you in, as you mentioned, if you're typing long sentence statements and you're making an error, we're doing that in real time. We're putting little underlying red squiggly lines to say there's something wrong with that part of a program statement, or you're using a variable that we don't know what its type is, for example, in certain languages.
So to some degree, that's someone kind of sitting behind you, double-checking and going, hey, by the way, there's a problem here.
Over your shoulder. We call that the sort of kibitzing mode. There's these threads that are running in the background that are checking everything you're doing, and they're going out to, you know, the database. We're going out to the project system to make sure we understand what it is you're trying to do. Uh-huh. Another thing that some of our environments do is they have visual design. So when you're trying to create your menus, your windows, your dialog boxes, all the things that are the user interface of an application, we have rapid application development tools built in the IDE, so you can drag and drop components, drag a menu component down and key in the menu items versus having to go to some cryptic editor to go and put text strings in and wonder what it's going to look like.
Right, and so this gives you a visual representation of what the menu is going to be and gives you ability to just edit. And then what's actually happening in the back end is that's turning into a big block of code that you don't actually edit.
And resources that get put together to create your application. Or you're building a web application, so you're dragging and dropping text array components and buttons and things of that kind. Mm-hmm. And then you're helped in writing the code on the server side that's going to populate, you know, the name, address, phone number inside of a web page, for example, if you're going in. Also, we talk to databases. So you got databases out there, and every database has different ways of connecting to it and different commands you send to it. It may all use the same thing called a structured query language or SQL, but they all have their different interfaces. We have a set of components that give you a universal way to talk to all databases.
So theoretically, if you're developing in a CodeGear IDE, a software package that connects to a database, you could switch the database later on. It wouldn't
Oracle,
matter which
DB2,
database.
Oracle, DB2, MySQL, doesn't matter what it is.
Okay. Yeah. I want to get in. One of the things that kind of got me interested in CodeGear was I'm a Ruby on Rails developer, and you've actually got a Ruby on Rails development environment called Third Rail. And Ruby on Rails is a software development environment. Well, it's a framework for web application development. And some of the tools that I use for editing the GeekSpeak site are actually done in Ruby on Rails. And I understand the idea of producing an IDE for it because it's got such a structured framework where and actually a lot of the tools are scripts in the Rails environment. There's a lot of tools that are actually scripts that generate code blocks for you. That's very IDE-like. So what on top of that do you add with Third Rail?
So we on top of that in the environment, we let you navigate very easily and simply around the different parts of your Rails application, whether it's the database migrations or it's the code or it's the views, the things that are going to generate what the end user would see in the web application. We also show dependencies. So if you're using a certain object, what other parts of your application or in the Rails framework depend on those? And then finally, if you're doing Rails development, you're in TextMate, then when you want to go and run commands, you go to a command window and you switch tasks and you go over there. Well, we have inside the environment, we have commanders, we call them. You can open up multiple ones of them. And anything you can do in the development environment at Third Rail, you can also do in the command windows. And everything you can do in the command windows, you can also do in the environment. So you don't have to make that contextual switch. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's on multiple screens and you're switching back and forth.
It's interesting because when you're talking about IDE environments, you're talking about software developments, there's almost an esoterical thing. Like, why is it nice if you're having discussion with somebody to drink tea in a garden rather than inside a train station? Like, they're both functional, right? You can hear each other and everything. But there's an aesthetic that leads to better communication, better productivity, depending on the task you're doing. And I think that's kind of that almost esoteric thing is what really makes a good IDE. So how do you design that?
So we talk to a lot of customers around the world. Part of my job, and there are others in our field organization as well as our development organization, we listen a lot, we talk to customers, but we're developers as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been a programmer for 39 years. Of course, there's new people getting into programming that think differently as well, so we have to talk with them. We gather requirements. We do sort of traditional business processes of gathering the requirements, doing competitive analysis, things of that kind. But we also just talk to people, talk to developers. We go to meetups. We go to user groups. We go to all sorts of places. We watch what's going on. I think the other thing is that we're always driven by how can we improve the process of programming? How can we improve the process of software engineering, this thing we call? How can we move the state of the art forward? How can we support more platforms, more databases, more operating systems? How can we extend the reach of our products to allow people to build new kinds of applications? So when the web came out, it was like, now we have to logically extend our development environments so that you can develop and live in a web world as well. So the breadth and depth of the IDEs can grow to meet the needs of application developers, if you're into multi-tier distributed applications, if you're into embedded systems, if you're you're caring about desktop applications of some kind.
Right.
We have to logically extend the way the languages work, the way the components work, the way the environments work.
How many developers do you have at CodeGear?
There's 200 of us total, and it's about, I'd say about 40% are developers.
Wow.
And then in the Embarcadero company, they have probably about 300 people worldwide. And again, so it's probably the same kind of thing.
We're
going to
go
to about 500, right. 500 employees worldwide.
Wow. And a big part of what an IDE is that environment itself, the menu items, the way that it functions. And traditionally, that's not considered a programmer that designs that. It's a user interface designer. It's almost an artistic skill. Do you have those people in-house?
So we do, and we also use other people to give us input as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. I understand Ruby on Rails and how you could make it it's a pretty framework structure. And the reason why I took it on is I like this idea of not duplicating the effort over and over again with web development.
Sure.
You also have a development environment for PHP, and PHP can be done in so many different ways. How do you structure an application software package that will create a place that works for all the different types of PHP development you can be doing?
So in PHP, you have the language, and you have massive numbers of function libraries.
Yes.
And you have script code as well, sort of intertwined in what makes the browser-side user interface. And so what we did that was different with our Delphi for PHP product is we said, we want to take the same drag and drop visual design environment, but still let PHP developers use the language they like, which is PHP. And that's what we do is the component layer is an object wrapper over the top of script code and PHP code. And it can execute both on the server side and on the browser side. And so we wanted to have this drag-and-drop visual design of your applications, visual design of the server-side connected databases. And that's what we did with Delphi for PHP. You can use all your PHP code. You can use all your script code. You can choose to use it directly, or you can choose to wrap it and build reusable components.
Okay.
And I think the thing we always say in our products is we don't keep you as a developer from doing anything. If you want to use the command line, use the command line. If you want to use a command prompt, if you want to change the way the code looks, you can change the code. You know, if you need to get at a Windows API, if you're a Windows programmer or a Macintosh API, you can. If you want to use a different library, you want to do some in JavaScript, great, have at it.
And are you setting up, do you use best practices for connecting to a database? Like, is that tool still a library of yours that's a PHP library that allows you to connect to a database? Or, how do you do that aspect?
So we have both direct connect to Oracle, MySQL, and our own Interbase database through the components. And you can also use ADODB if you want to go to lots of other databases. So for speed, we go direct to the client API of a database, but you can also go through an intermediate layer.
All right, cool. Well, let's start taking some calls. We're taking calls with questions and comments about development, preferably, but we will take any call you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Moss Landing, Bruce, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, thank you. Quick question. Just what I've seen, and I work in a development environment and dealing with applications that are going to back-end databases in large corporate environments, insurance, banks, so forth, and what something that we're trying to wrestle with and maybe can speak to in terms of maybe the way the IDEs are evolving is a situation where you're coding an application for the client, if you will, that's then impacting a WebSphere server and its code base and rev level, and then it's going beyond that to a JCL that's interfacing to a database that's also at different rev levels, so that what we're finding is almost that as each of these four segments are doing their own development, testing becomes virtually impossible because you don't have a static test environment. Each of those four key areas, in a vertical sense, is changing daily. So testing becomes kind of almost impossible. It becomes almost a trial and error to figure out what was changed and what broke, and yet these are actually production environments that we're dealing with.
Bruce, do you have a mirrored development environment or a launch environment?
Well, see, that's the problem is you do at each level.
Yeah.
But you don't across the chain.
Right. Okay, David, what do you got?
Well, In our products, we support multiple levels of for in our Java product like JBuilder, we support multiple application servers, multiple versions of application servers, and of course, multiple versions of databases as well. I think the challenge is exactly what he's mentioning, is that you've got this sort of development environment and platform that you're developing with. You've got this test world that you might live with, and then you've got production where you have to make sure it runs with different things. You got to set up test environments for those different configurations, even if they're subsets of them.
You've got to have a test environment, a production environment, a test production environment, if you will.
Like because the production people are not going to let you screw around with their live system. Yeah.
Well, okay, how are you dealing with it right now, Bruce? I mean, you don't want to be breaking all these systems.
Well, what you end up doing, really, is trying to, again, play detective and figure out, you know, what changed that nobody told you about. Because literally, oftentimes, the production environment will change to a different rev level, and then you have to say, okay, what else? What changed in that change to the next rev level? Because maybe it'd be the JCL or something else. So it's almost like, you know, NASA, where when they're putting the Apollo up to the moon, they'd never done it before. They really couldn't create a test environment. So you have to take a different approach. I hate to use the word paradigm, but you know that's what you all have to do, is have a different approach with what we're entering into with the SOA, you know, the surface oriented architecture, than what we've got before. It seems like we're having to take a giant step, and yet people don't even seem to perceive the problem, much less have tools being applied to cope with it.
So what we do at CodeGear to deal with all the different kinds of infrastructures that we have to test against is we use virtualization. So we use VMware. We have big VMware servers. We have lots of virtual servers with every different kind of version of things that our customers would have running on them. Hmm. Now, if somebody just put an update, we may not have that update yet to stick it into one of our virtual servers, but then we run automated testing of our products against all those different virtual machines.
So, Bruce, it kind of sounds like to me that you don't have the corporate level understanding of the production path design.
No, we're just dealing with external customers that may be five rev levels back on their database. And
so you're talking about environments you don't even you're not managing. You're helping people take your code.
Customer environments.
I mean, that is tough. Cases, I guess it is to go, well, we need a copy of your environment and do a virtual server and then test off of it. But that seems a little...
Well, that's hard when you get into the mainframe world, because then it's one thing when you're dealing with different, saying, oh, let's have a little web box server to the side. But once you get into the mainframe space, it's very hard for people to commit the resources to have these various test environments. That's why I wondered, it sounds like the virtualization approach is one way to get around to avoiding having to have multiple mainframe environments, but you're still having to set those up basically to mirror customer environments.
Yeah. And that there's no way otherwise. I mean, you could try to emulate, but I think it was David Parnas, a famous computer scientist about Star Wars, who said the only way you're going to really know and to test it is to actually use it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Bye. Bye-bye.
From Santa Cruz, Hal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I don't know if this question's geeky enough for your guests or you guys this morning, but your comment about web development prompted me to ask for your comments relative to Plone as a website platform versus the alternatives.
Yeah, well, Miles and I have a little bit of experience with Plone. Plone has started to grow quite a bit in the I work for the University of California at Santa Cruz, and across the University of California there's a lot of Plone use. Plone is a web development architecture that's based off of Zope, which is all Python-based, and I think it's really quite a good system. It's gotten better. When Miles and I were dealing with it, it was messier, and I think it's improved quite a bit. I think for what are they called, Miles, that environment? I'm blanking.
A CMS.
Thank you.
Content management system.
That's how we met, right, Miles, building CMSs. So I think it's a pretty good solution. I would say go for it. One of the you're going to have a couple problems with Plone's kind of environment is that the company that's going to host you, the ISP, if you will, or the service provider, they might not support it because it's not as mainstream, if you will, as some PHP-based thing. Another one that I think gets a lot of play at this point is Text Pattern and Expression Engine. So
can you explain what that is?
Text Pattern is a PHP, not Text Pattern. Is that what it's called? Yeah, Text Pattern. It's PHP MySQL CMS, content management system. A web content management system is a system that manages a website where the users there's two different kinds of people. There's a user that comes and sees it as a website, and there's a user that comes and actually can edit the content, and all of it's done through the web browser. So that's a content management system online. Plone is one of those. I think it's really functional. Text Pattern is another one. And the third that I would recommend looking into is Expression Engine. So those are three open source content management systems, which I think are pretty good. I think Expression Engine is open source. So if you're going to look at Plone, look at the other two as well.
Well, I've already invested in the Plone site and
okay.
having some problems, in part because it appears that it's favored by large corporations, and most of the consultants around here and even up in the Bay Area are very busy. The one we contacted recently said they don't take projects smaller than $100,000, et cetera. And so that has turned out to be a disadvantage for us.
We're yeah. Kind of How big is your organization?
Very small.
Yeah. I mean, if you, that's the one thing with content management systems where you when you want to modify them outside their kind of base install, even if you want to theme them, it does start to become kind of difficult. One of the things I didn't like about Plone was its focus on being able to do anything. And it is a little complex. And I wanted to make some enhancements where I hired Miles, who's a pretty competent developer in Java. And he came in and, Miles, I want to speak for you, but you had a hard time with Python at that point, didn't you?
Right, and that may have just been my inexperience with the language, trying to work with it. But
but Python's now being taught in schools, so if you were to go to, for example, UCSC and ask one of the instructors, and faculty in general at universities are pretty responsive to things like this, and say, I want to get a just graduated or haven't even graduated computer science student who knows Python and pay them pretty much nothing compared to what main software developers get, you probably could get a pretty good support person that would be able to modify Python Plone for you quite well. And that's what I'd recommend you doing.
Yeah, gotten into the CSS and the developer tool and done a little bit of changing around of the skin ourselves, but the problems we're having now are embedded in, I don't know, the database and a lot of
the back end, the actual code.
Yeah, and a right out of college or right still in college CS student, computer science student, can probably take care of this for you.
Oh, really?
And they're not going to be as expensive. In fact, it's possible that they could get credit for doing the work as a work-study type thing.
I'm going to email you guys for some suggested faculty members to contact.
Well, please do so. In fact, if you go to danm.ucsc.edu and look up Lyle, that's my day job, and I'd be happy to point you in the right direction.
D-A-M-M?
Yeah, Digital Arts and New Media. Digital Arts, New Media. That's my day job.
At UCSC?
UCSC. Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Or you can just do a Lyle search at UCSC. You'll find me.
Thank you
so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to go ahead and go on to a PHP question, I guess, from Santa Cruz. Mike, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, how's it going? It's sort of a PHP question, and I'm not a real PHP developer, but I find myself touching more and more PHP code. And I've noticed with a lot of there's a real tendency in the PHP community to apply these mods to products. And I guess it seems people seem to like it that way, but I'm wondering if people like working with PHP in this kind of way that makes me really nervous as more of an object-oriented Java developer. If people like working that way, I'm wondering if PHP could eventually evolve into something more like a functional programming language, where there aren't a lot of variables floating around. In fact, there aren't variables. It's just sort of one function getting a result, applying another process to it. So the code, it seems like PHP could almost become an attractive language if they got rid of all these variables floating around and went to a more functional approach.
Right, but then again, it wouldn't be PHP anymore, would it?
Yeah.
It would be a functional programming language.
Right. I guess you're exactly right. And maybe what I'm sort of imagining is people, a lot of people seem to like that freewheeling quality of PHP.
Yeah.
And I'm just, and as a developer who's just beginning to wrap my head around some of the advantages of functional programming languages, I'm wondering if there could be a kind of a middle or a new ground that's, not Java and not PHP, but something...
That's kind of the impetus of Ruby on Rails environment was this frustrated PHP developer going, there's got to be a better way to structure all this stuff, kind of to start getting away from a lot of this, main script that's running all your functions.
Or frustrated Java developers with all the different web choices there
yeah.
and complexity
of APIs. I actually kind of gravitate towards Python earlier, so it's kind of hard for me to switch over to Ruby on Rails, not for no other reason than it's sort of it's just almost too close to Python.
Yeah. So, I would suggest you take a look at Django, which is a framework not unsimilar to Rails, which is a Python framework for web development. And it's I think it's pretty clean and nice if you're going to be in Python.
I should say for PHP, you might be talking more about PHP 4, which had sort of rudimentary objects, if at all.
No, 5.
And 5 added objects, and there's some frameworks coming at us in. We built Delphi for PHP and the whole RAD visual design environment on top of PHP 5, so the components are extensions on top of PHP 5 objects.
So you're conceptual. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have properties, methods, events, both JavaScript events and server-side events, and it's pretty straightforward. You might check out. You can download the trial, Delphi for PHP, from the CodeGear website.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. I'll have a look at it.
Well, thanks for the call. It's a very good point about Python PHP development, where you really can come into a rat's nest of an application, especially since there's so many open source ones, and then one developer will do one thing, and it can get messy.
Yeah, PHP is, in my opinion, very much a baling wire and duct tape, but then again, some people have made some really amazing things with baling wire and duct tape.
But we changed that again. I mean, and the other thing I should say about Delphi for PHP, I'll put a plug in here, is the component library is called VCL for PHP, Visual Component Library, and it's completely open sourced and all written in PHP.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the call. Oh, I guess he's done with us.
Interesting to talk about functional languages sometime, maybe, but maybe that's another time.
Yeah, I think I'm going to not ask for any more calls because we only have about 5 minutes or so before we go to the KOSP radio auction, which is quite exciting. There's a whole crew of people standing by to take over the Airstream, and it's going to be on location, and you can actually go to the auction. That's just a few more minutes. Let me put forth... do I have any more?
That's another language.
I'll leave it up to you, David. You got something else you want to touch on today?
No, I think it's just, you know, as we look at the world of programming and programming languages, it comes back to some of the things you were talking about in the news. You know, there's lots of different standards. There's lots of different frameworks. There's lots of different choices. And there's no one language to fit everything that somebody wants to do. I mean, and the great thing is it's great to have support for lots of languages or be able to have those choices as well. Just as we choose different databases, we choose different machines, we choose different operating systems and so on.
Alex, who's our regular listener from down south, he's actually a geek. He participates through chat, so he gets to ask his questions. And one of the things he's asking is, what's your stance on helping developers create secure applications? Focus on secure.
So there's a few things you can do down at sort of link layer and encryption layers with encryption libraries and so on. The other thing is in some of our products we have these audits that you can run. So they go through and they expose suspicious pieces of code that you should look at. Mm-hmm. So you run through the source code with all these different audits. You can look for complexity. You can look for pointers that are being used after their lifetime and things of that kind. We also do runtime error detection. Some people try to overflow a stack, overflow an array to see what that might do in programs. And so not that they're done on purpose by programmers, but we have these runtime tools and detection and also source code static analysis tools as well. So, and that gives you pointers to things you should explore.
Would the runtime tools catch things like SQL injection attacks? Do you look for things like that?
That'll come when CodeGear is in part of Embarcadero because they have the SQL debugging, SQL profiling, SQL detection, and more than we do on the code side.
What about general input validation for a program?
So there, it's sort of left up to the developer and the libraries and what they do. So on Rails, for example, in our wizards, when we're creating migrations, you can specify what the links are, and then code gets generated to test for somebody overrunning inputs or putting strange information in input.
And volume. So in SQL injection, are you handling it now, or are you just kind of totally waiting until the new group comes?
We're not handling it directly.
Okay. So that's a concern at this point, and a good growth for you to go ahead and be joining up with Embarcadero.
Merging the Embarcadero technologies on the database development and management side and the stuff we're doing on coding is going to be really cool, and optimization as well.
All right. Wonderful. GeekSpeak is... Well, no, I've got a little bit more time. Did Alex have any more questions, Miles? Or do you have another question?
Well, he was bringing up other examples like cross-site scripting attacks, but this is going to be in that bunch you're in there. But he was expressing a frustration in that a lot of the fact that security problems are put off to the programmers, one of the problems is that each programmer is going to have a different skill set with dealing with security, security being its own skill set in and of itself.
But there's other things. There's sandboxing in the a la Java space. Right. Inside the browsers now, they're putting wrappers around things that might execute either in script code or client-side download. You know.
Right. I actually remember having this conversation with another developer as well. Java has that ability to sandbox to say any arbitrary application, you're allowed to write to this directory, but none of the others. But how does that work out for developers in Python or Ruby or
then it's like that? You know, you either can do some things yourself in the tooling, and you can do it in the runtimes or the frameworks. You can put the operating system can sit some things. I mean, there's so much complexity going on in these boxes, in all of them, that it's going to take a multi-effort. You know, you can't just say we can do it only in the programming language, or we can only do it in the library, or we can only do it in the tooling.
But isn't
it's got to be done everywhere.
Isn't the IDE a good place to kind of start to make sure that takes place?
So we do that with these hints and helps. Right. You know, as you're typing along, the audits can be run against it, so we can immediately say that's a suspicious behavior. But again, if the programmer just chooses to ignore it,
they do ignore it.
I think of PHP development, where to look for, are they using a database connection, like to an execute call? Are you just passing the single string version, or are you passing in the parameterized?
Right, and there is a tool for doing the parameterized, and you can do that, but a lot of people don't do it that way.
Well, in some real worlds, you don't even send SQL to a database.
Right.
We have customers like ADP that all you get is a stored procedure interface. You know, right. You don't send SQL. You don't do any updates. You send parameters to a call.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks. My name's Lyle Troxell. We also had David Intersimone from Code Gear talking about software development. David and Miles and Ryder, thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to be here.
You're welcome to learn quite a bit more at codegear.com. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org. We're here every week with questions and comments on air, but we also help you on our forums. If you'd like to ask us anything you'd like, you're welcome to do so all week long. If you're a geek and listen to GeekSpeak, we'd love your help on the forums. It's always a useful thing to have some people joining us. You can go to geekspeak.org and click on the forums to do so. David holds a BS in computer science from Cal Poly and is currently vice president of development relations for Code Gear. And David, it really was wonderful to talk with you, and I'm hoping to keep a relationship open with you and maybe have you on again, especially as this whole merger of Code Gear and Embarcadero gets further along.
We'll be in Scotts Valley, so we're close by.
Are you staying in Scotts Valley?
Absolutely. And I live in La Selva Beach, so we're close by.
All right, so you're definitely a Central Coast native, if you will.
Yep.
Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.